Well, thank you, Richard. It's a great honor to be back and to speak to the Philadelphia Society. My topic this morning is the parties and the Constitution. And I plan to talk about two parties, the Democrats and the Whigs, and two Supreme Court cases decided on constitutional grounds, Prigg v. Pennsylvania in 1842 and Dred Scott v. Sanford in 1857. Since the second great compromise of the 1780s, the Ratification Compromise, whereby opponents of ratification of the Philadelphia drafted Constitution agreed to vote in its favor on the promise of immediate amendment in the form of a Bill of Rights. The reason, I think, Charles, that there was no anti-constitutional party that survived the ratification debate. Since then, it was the genius of American constitutionalism to suppose that the Constitution itself was above party difference. All Americans agreed then upon the Constitution, and maybe as well upon the Declaration of Independence on which it was based. And indeed, all office holders took an oath to support it, even as they differed vehemently among themselves over questions of public policy, foreign and domestic. Like a kind of game theory before that was invented, parties realized more or less that whatever constitutional claims they made on behalf of governmental power when their party held it, or on behalf of individual rights when they were out of power, could be claimed by their opponents when the roles were reversed. And this had the effect, at least for those with a little foresight, of moderating their assertions both of powers and rights. Of course, it was not so simple. Early parties soon enough developed distinctive ways of interpreting their shared constitution. We are familiar with this today, as modern Republicans generally call themselves originalists, and modern Democrats endorse an evolving constitution, as was pointed out earlier this morning. But I think in the era we are examining, and maybe also today, there's one constitution, but still two interpretations of that constitution. Or in other words, this two constitutions or two interpretations of the constitution goes way back. In the first half of the 19th century, Democrats generally understood the constitution as a compact among states. They thought its language, or at least federal powers, should be strictly construed. And they held that the original intent of its makers was decisive. While the Whigs, on the other hand, like their Federalist ancestors, tended to see the Constitution not as a compact, but as an act of the people. And they thought it should be liberally construed according to the nature and reason of the thing, or at least its powers should be. And that, embedded as it was in common law, it should be allowed to grow and develop through settled usages. Now, if I were to have as my task the elaboration of these characteristic positions, I would speak about cases that concerned the party's different views of the role of governments, national and state, in promoting economic growth or in keeping their hands off a free market while exercising their powers of police. Cases like McCulloch v. Maryland, Gibbons v. Ogden, and then as you get into the Democratic Whig era, Charles River Bridge, the passenger cases, Cooley versus Board of Wardens, and the like. But since our panel has in its title a recognition that things fell apart, this Democratic-Whig difference, I'll speak instead about the two leading slavery cases of the era, and we'll do this by discussing three justices' opinions in each case, and two of these justices wrote in both cases. Prigg v. Pennsylvania came to the court in 1842, and it concerned the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 and the Personal Liberty Statute of Pennsylvania that forbade forcible removal of a person of color from the state. The opinion of the court was written by Joseph Story, upholding the federal act and striking the Pennsylvania statute as interfering with it. Congress having the power under the Necessary and Proper Clause to legislate to carry into execution all powers vested in the Constitution by any department or officer of government, and the Fugitive Slave Clause of Article 4, Section 2, mandating that fugitives from labor be, quote, delivered up, Congress was within its authority, thought Story, to specify the process, namely allowing fugitives to be captured and transported back to the state where they were bound, provided that they receive a judge's certificate proving ownership. Moreover, federal power over fugitive slaves, wrote Story, was exclusive because slavery itself existed only as a matter of positive law. He endorsed the Somerset Doctrine from the 1772 case in England that under natural law and common law, no one is born a slave. And as for the right to recover a fugitive slave, it was itself only a positive constitutional right established at the convention as a matter of compromise, since the law of nations did not require states to recognize each other's slaves except as they chose to as a matter of comity. Story, known as an anti-slavery man from Massachusetts, apparently thought that his dicta endorsing natural liberty in the absence of slavery and common law would overshadow his ruling upholding the Fugitive Slave Act and striking down the Pennsylvania law as interfering with it, a compromise he thought would settle a key point in the slavery controversy that was then simmering. But in fact, the case destroyed his reputation in anti-slavery circles and left him bitter at the end of his career. He died just a few years later. Neither a Whig nor a Democrat, by the way, Story could best be described as a national Republican, appointed to the court by James Madison in 1812. He still holds the record of being the youngest man ever appointed to the court. He was barely 30 at the time. And becoming not only a close associate of John Marshall's, but also the first law professor at Harvard in 1827, I think it was, and a prolific author of legal treatises concurrently with his service on the bench, including, by the way, one of the first systematic works on the conflict of laws. Now, Story's opinion commanded a majority on the court in 1842, but it was met by a concurrence from Roger Taney, the Chief Justice, appointed upon Marshall's death by Andrew Jackson after serving in his administration and in that capacity both drafting the famous bank veto message and removing federal deposits from the Bank of the United States after the veto was sustained. Taney was the quintessential Democratic judge who had quickly countered Story in the Charles River Bridge case, upholding a free market presumption against a purported state monopoly treated by Story as a vested right. In general, Taney was an advocate of state police power and states' rights, but his concurrence in Prigg at once endorses federal power, he joins the court in upholding the Fugitive Slave Act, and allows not the Pennsylvania law, but state statutes that would assist in the capture of fugitive slaves. So not laws that would impede, but laws that would assist in the capture of fugitive slaves. Story had said that anything concerning fugitive slaves was exclusively a matter of federal power. Actually, insisting that there is no difference between property and slaves and any other form of property, Taney thinks that the Fugitive Slave Act itself was superfluous, arguing that slave owners had a right of recapture directly from the Fugitive Slave Clause without the need to obtain a certificate from a magistrate judge. As for the states, since the slave states could legislate for the capture of runaways within their borders, there was no reason they could not legislate for the captures of runaways who crossed state lines. Since Story thought slavery was not a vested right, but a positive law right only, the status of slave could follow a person across state lines only because the Constitution explicitly said so. This is Story. And, or rather, almost explicitly said so, because, of course, the word slave isn't in the Constitution at all. Taney already sees slavery as a vested property right, that one man could hold in another, or, as we'll later see from his Dred Scott opinion, one white man could hold in a black. The most interesting opinion in Prigg, I think, was by Justice John McLean, McLean, who had served as Postmaster General from Monroe through John Quincy Adams, was a Democrat who had supported Andrew Jackson for the presidency, and having declined Jackson's offer of a high cabinet post or two, became Jackson's first appointment to the court right away in 1829. Born in New Jersey, moving with his family through Virginia and Kentucky, and settling in Ohio, studying at Harvard, less than a decade after Story did, McLean joined most of Story's opinion in Prague, but differed on one point, namely the constitutionality of the Pennsylvania law. Noting the origin of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 as a congressional response to a dispute between Pennsylvania and Virginia over the refusal of the latter to extradite men who were accused by Pennsylvania of kidnapping a free black man in violation of its law, McLean would interpret the Pennsylvania Act as a legitimate exercise of the state police power to protect the individual liberty of free people of color and prevent disruption of the public peace by slave catchers. Since he saw the act as protecting free blacks, not fugitive slaves, he didn't think that it was in conflict with the federal act. Acknowledging exclusive federal power over fugitive slaves, McLean interpreted the Pennsylvania Act to be consistent with it. The slave family at issue in Prague might be returned to Maryland under the federal act if they could be proved to have been slaves in Maryland, McLean thought, but they could appeal to Pennsylvania law insofar as they had a claim to be free. Now, the notorious case of Dred Scott comes to the court about 15 years after Prague, years which saw the Mexican War, the consequent expansion of slave territory, the end of the balance of slave and free states with the admission of California, and the enactment, partly as a result of Prague, of a more vigorous fugitive slave law as part of the Compromise of 1850. At issue in Dred Scott was the freedom of a slave, slave family that had been removed from the South, first to Illinois, a free state, and then to the federal Fort Snelling in the newly organized territory of Wisconsin, the owner of the slaves being a United States Army surgeon. The slave, Dred Scott, had come from Missouri and being returned there began his suit in Missouri courts. He claimed, with previous Missouri precedents and those of other states, including Louisiana, by the way, on his side, that his being taken back by his master, I'm sorry, that his being taken by his master to a free state was effectively manumission. And once free, always free was the maxim, as American law held that one could be born a slave but could in no other way become a slave. Missouri courts, instead, this time held that while Scott might have been declared free if he had brought his case while under the protection of the laws of Illinois, in Illinois, depending on the local law of domicile and the law of sojourn, whether or not Illinois allowed slaves to pass through the states or be there temporarily with their masters, as, for instance, New Jersey did, which is why all the Southern boys went to Princeton. Well, it's true, right? I mean, if you go into Nassau Hall today, they proudly... Well, 10 years ago, they proudly said half were from the North, half of the casualties were from the South in the Civil War on the wall. But apparently that was the reason the Southerners were there is that New Jersey allowed them to bring along their servants. But the Missouri courts were not bound to enforce Illinois law extraterritorially. In fact, not able to, was the argument, following the English case of the slave Grace, a sort of complement to Somerset, which allowed the enslavement of a woman in the colonies, the British colonies, who had been to Britain but had not claimed her freedom on British soil, but had, in the sight of the law, voluntarily followed her master home, like Sally Hemings. Chief Justice Taney writes the lead opinion in Dred Scott on appeal, not merely deferring to the Missouri court, but instead declaiming, first, that people of African descent like Scott could never be citizens of the United States under the Constitution, citing purported original intent, and secondly, that Congress was without power to forbid slavery in the territories, since the right to hold slaves was, quote, distinctly and expressly affirmed in the Constitution. And the territories, as the common property America ought to be open to all Americans who ought to be able to move through, to move there with whatever they owned, furniture, wagons, oxen, horses, and slaves. Seen through the powerful argument of Lincoln in his debates with Douglas, Taney's argument seems in retrospect preposterous to us, I think, on a first reading. But in fact, it's important to recognize that much of what he said reflected mainstream thinking in the Democratic Party, stretching back at least to the Missouri crisis of 1820. The argument was that the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, passed by the Articles Congress and repassed by the new Congress, was originally not an act of legislation. The Articles Congress couldn't legislate, but it was rather a compact among the states that accepted the cession of land north of the Ohio by Virginia, and Virginia's own agreement to include in that compact a prohibition on slavery north of the Ohio. On this account, slavery was acknowledged in the Louisiana Territory by the Treaty of Purchase, and that meant slavery could not be forbidden there until such time as states were formed and admitted to the Union. The Constitution's language about Congress making, quote, needful rules and regulations about the territories was read narrowly or strictly by Taney and the Democrats as something much less than comprehensive legislative power, which is given to Congress only for the 10-mile square that would be the Capitol. As for Taney's view of the possible citizenship of free blacks, I think Taney invented this part as a constitutional matter, however much it was part of the common sense of most Democrats and maybe even most white Republicans at the time. I'm sorry, most Americans at the time, not Republicans necessarily. McLean dissented vigorously in Dred Scott, citing Prigg and endorsing its invocation of Somerset, the presumption of liberty in the absence of positive law. He holds that Scott was freed both by being brought to Illinois, where slavery was illegal, and by being brought into federal territory, where slavery was illegal. He interprets the needful rules and regulations language as a full grant of legislative power, dismisses the claim that the Louisiana Treaty had preserved the territory as slave territory, since the northern part was then wilderness, and besides, no treaty could abrogate Congress's power to legislate. The most interesting opinion in Dred Scott, though, I think, was by Benjamin Curtis, the only Whig justice appointed by a Whig president. Curtis nicely and carefully explodes Taney's claim of original intent concerning the question of black citizenship, arguing that citizenship under the Constitution was, except for the removal of the impediment of alienage, left to the states to determine, and slavery clearly and showing clearly that blacks, free blacks, were citizens and even voters in some of the original states. Even more interesting was how he dealt with the question of Scott's freedom, aware of the complex conflict of laws that Story himself had endorsed the slave Grace case in private correspondence. Curtis doesn't presume to settle the law of Illinois or even the territories, but he interprets Scott's marriage at Fort Snelling with his master's consent to be the moment of his emancipation, since it now defined his status and his slave bride status under the law of freedom and established it as a status incompatible with slavery. Here you see his thinking as a common lawyer. A full understanding of the meaning of rights at law is embedded in an entire legal order, and legislation plays a role in determining such rights, but is not exclusive. Quickly, 3 points to sum up as to what difference this makes today. First, the difference over the meaning of the Constitution is a part of party conflict. This itself shouldn't be thought illegitimate, but needs to be engaged in, recognizing that each party thinks its interpretation is correct. Second, it's dangerous when the court tries to impose a partisan interpretation as a matter of constitutional law, and better if they confine themselves to those settled matters, as, for instance, the bank became after Madison signs the second bank bill. And finally, it seems to me that judges do better if they attend to rights in all their particular nuance, as Curtis did, aware of the full meaning of liberty, not only in the constitutional text, but also in the common law. Thank you.